Dear editors of Magazine Forte, your term post-shamanism seems poignant, emphasizing, as it does, that the shaman is by now virtually a figure of the distant past. I suppose when we think of the shaman, we think of one who was an ambassador to spirits once believed to inhabit every aspect of this material world. Post-shamanism, then, points me first to a conflict of worldviews, and then to the gradual dominance of Western thought, conditioned by secularism, Cartesianism, rationalism. The sociologist Max Weber went so far as to say that the entire history of Western culture is the story of the gradual removal of magic from the world. He wrote dialectically of rationalism and disenchantment, the devaluation of mysticism over time. I was thinking of the shaman in American history, how our government acquired the vast wilderness territories where Native American tribes still lived. Unlike them, we were steeped in rationalism. We knew that if there was a spiritual realm, it was far from the earth. To process this land, then, we devised an elegant grid system to divide, name, and sell it, oftentimes sight unseen, to investors back east. The grid was immensely powerful as a concept for controlling nature. Infinitely repeatable modules, called townships, were overlaid onto the landscape, regardless of its terrain, natural features, or plant and animal life. A section of land, delineated according to the system, did not have to be known, understood, or even experienced in order to be controlled and owned remotely. It simply needed to be locked into measurement. Then it could be given a name in the system, even such a name as S11T28NR20W4PM, which we now know as the area of Afton, Minnesota. Ultimately, 3/4 of the entire area of the United States was developed through this, the public land survey system. Native American shamans surely contemplated the spiritual aspects of the grid. Inorganic, indiscriminate, purely repetitive, infinitely expandable. It is a telling detail that Black Elk, a shaman of the Lakota Sioux tribe, described how his spiritual powers diminished after the U.S. Army made him live in a rectilinear building instead of in his round teepee. Perhaps the shaman and the Western thinker would at least agree that acts of measuring and naming push a thing away from the infinite. What then of the unmeasured, the unnamed? How to approach the immeasurable, the unnameable? Alain Badiou maintains that the truth comes forward as a hole in logic, a hole in the senses, as that which knowledge prohibits, and that we are charged with upholding the murmur of the indiscernible. We are Westerners, all beneficiaries of elegant tools like the grid. Our houses, our studios, our canvases are rectilinear, touched by the practical. Post-shamanism seems to ask, can there be any point of convergence? These are things to consider when we find ourselves in a secure, though spiritless, material world, in a square room of doubt, of nausea, rendered in glass and steel, maybe leather. Warm regards, Scott Lawrence.
Forte, fourth issue.
La vie s'écoule, la vie.
Life goes by. Life slips away, days march by, lethargically. Party of the Reds, party of the Greys, our revolutions are betrayed. Party of the Reds, party of the Greys, our revolutions are betrayed. Work kills, work pays, time sells as a commodity. Time once paid never returns. The youth is dying from lost time. Time once paid never returns. The youth is dying from lost time. I made for the love of loving are the reflections of the world of objects. Without dreams and without reality to images, we are faded. Without dreams and without reality to images, we are faded. The executed, the starved, come to us from the depths of time. Nothing has changed, but everything has begun and shall blossom to violence. Nothing has changed, but everything has begun. Rien n'a changé, mais tout commence et va mûrir dans dens of clerics, nests of merchants, of cops. It is from the wind that sows the whirlwind that days of joy are reaped. It is from the wind that sows the whirlwind that days of joy are reaped.
Au vent qui sème la
the guns aimed at us shall turn back on the rulers. No more leaders, no more state to profit from our battles.
Contre les chefs vont
no
se
more leaders, no more state to profit from our battles.
Pour profiter no de more leaders, nos combats.
No more state
plus de
to
dirigeants,
from our battles.
Plus d'État pour profiter de nos combats. Plus de dirigeants, plus d'État pour profiter de nos combats.
Number 39, Jian. Strange to be followed by deliverance, the tires of someone in need, the car doused with more windows, beggars collected in empty, airtight pill bottles, a broken mirror glued on the skylight in the bathroom. Stop looking at us, son. The wind pushed by the impression the scalp is a guitar, but this union has a tuba for a mouth and screams like a vacuum running in the hallway, raining only on the bridge, gum on top of my shoe. Strange to be followed, Plato is tectonic. I saw him in the steam. We are dogs on our own leashes. No human being is single-handed, and mountains, they drown simply by keeping still.
The songs that the shamans sing start about an hour or 40 minutes into the ceremony. So you're in this big circular structure called a holoka with 20 people, kind of like spokes on a wheel all around the edges, sitting there with the center of the holoka empty. And you drink the ayahuasca, and then the lights are out, and you're in complete silence, aside from the sounds of the jungle. You're just there with yourself for like 40 minutes to an hour before the sensations and the consciousness starts to shift. So that's in a way that the most frightening period, or can be the most frightening period of the experience, because you're just really untethered and you don't know what you're in for, really. Because every time you drink the medicine, it can be a very different experience. From incredibly euphoric to incredibly terrifying, or something in between. But you don't know what you're going to get, and it doesn't have to do with that batch or how much you've taken. It's just really a wild card. So there's an anxiety in that, in not knowing, but there's always that. We never know what the next moment holds. So you just are aware of...
It's just more extended. It's more stretched in that way.
It's more stretched in that you're hyper aware for a longer period of time of uncertainty. That always exists, and you feel it more the way that maybe you did when you were a baby, and babies are so, you know, always kind of in this very fragile emotional state, you feel that vulnerability, or like what you imagine a frightened animal would feel. So when the Icaros, the songs start, it's like a life raft. It's like you feel that there's something you can grab onto and feel a little more tethered. So that, in a way, makes them very comforting, but furthermore, they are part of the medicine. What I mean by that is that the shaman acquire them in their training, in their time in isolation in the jungle. They acquire them through dieta of their own, dieting plants, which means they'll cut their diet down dramatically to maybe fish, grains, and one plant. And that plant imparts knowledge and forms and melodies, Icaros, to the shaman, which they then use when someone comes to them and wants to work with ayahuasca. So, the songs also seem to have this quality that they can encourage or activate the medicine. I mean, the medicine would probably be active on its own, but the Icaros intensify and start to carry messages to you that you can understand, even though they're in the Shipibo language, which might have a couple similarities with Spanish, but other than that, it's completely indecipherable. If you don't, I don't know, it doesn't have relationships with any languages that I've been familiar with, so for me, it was very foreign linguistically, but I could understand the meaning or the message, almost the way you can understand if someone could I don't know why I thought of pantomime, but like for some reason the words were like pantomime mentally, and that's why the experience is almost telepathic to me. Acquire the information very directly, even though I didn't understand the words. And I remember nodding a lot, like, oh yeah, I know, I have to do that. Or, oh no, that's that way because of that. It was very, a lot of things were affirming things I already knew, and some things were giving me new information. A lot of people in the group, some people who are more experienced with ayahuasca would refer to that kind of process as receiving a download, which I thought, like a computer download, which I thought was kind of terrible at first. Information, yeah, where you feel like it's just coming to you, you are receiving information. And I found it a little icky or offensive at first to think about that metaphor, but it actually isn't a bad one. It started to make more sense to me as I was receiving these downloads.
But in which kind of form you would describe them? Like it's an information. It's image information. It's mathematical information.
I think it's different for everybody, and I think all of the above. But for me, sometimes there were visuals. The information was illustrated visually or represented, and sometimes it's just a discursive thing where a lot of question and answering, and maybe that's just because that's my notion of having a teacher. I was thinking as a kid teacher, so I had a back and forth exchange where I would think something and then I don't know what it is, but it would reply or respond. So some people might think of this as a conversation I was having with myself, a conversation I was having with an external entity, a conversation I was having with the plant, the shaman. I mean, you could speculate forever about who it was, but or what it was. That was. It just was. It was information that felt intuitively accurate.
And that was kind of underlined through the songs.
Yeah,
like it was kind of there was a help there through the songs.
Yes, the songs carry that message.
Yeah.
Almost as if you had a family member giving or putting a play about to you. It was like a song and dance delivery.
It was dance too. How is this? It's like rhythmically.
It wasn't really dance, but I guess there's a lot of hand gesturing
that our ancestors
and
had.
Touching.
And it's this very way of viewing the world, this way of looking at commodities, as Marx put it, as magical things, as fetishes, that ultimately prevents the vast majority of us from going to the streets and from building the new kinds of infrastructure that we need to survive. That somehow capitalism is sort of like a bad spell. It's a sort of a magical relationship that's gone wrong. It somehow we've gotten stuck in it, and we can't get out.
Okay, but if you consider the human brain and the human person, the human brain to be made up of, on a very basic level, neurons that fire based on information and sense experiences and the things that the person comes into contact with, then all that we are as human beings is individuals that are made up of the circumstances that we exist in. Whether we're made up of those, that information and that sense experience that we come into contact with, and whether you are born and grow up in circumstances where religious ideas are what you come into contact with, or whether commodities and capitalism is what you come into contact with. These are the circumstances that you understand and the circumstances in which you live.
I mean, the problem with that viewpoint is it's a whole metaphysics, a whole epistemology just taken for granted that ultimately, you know, yes, you could say people just transmit and reproduce what was given to them by their parents or by culture or that big bugbear society. But you do get the feeling that it is not so simple. That ultimately there are very fundamental differences in the very anthropology, the way we view ourselves, the way we view others, the way we relate to the world, and that these differences they can change in the blink of an eye, in a generation. I remember this truly wonderful experience I had with you. Remember when we went to we went to Antwerp, and while in Antwerp, you know, we went to this museum, and inside the museum it was astounding. We were trapped in this sort of strange world of artifacts and art and weird videos, nothing which made any sense. And then as we walked outside, we expected everything to return to normal, but it didn't. Instead, what we noticed was how bizarre and how strange the world actually was. We went to the harbor, and in the harbor we saw, you know, factories on boats getting ready to be moved across the world, you know, from Belgium to China. We saw, you know, it seemed like everything that we considered normal, that we considered to be somehow perfect, was actually nothing but a massive delirium that we had been trapped in. That beneath this delirium, there was entirely different ways of seeing things that we hadn't yet experienced. And it seems to me that the true task of revolutionaries must somehow be to look at, to discover what it is that can create new kinds of rituals, new kinds of relationships with each other and with things. And that's where I think, maybe that's where the antagonism, the pure negation of the riot, the destruction of the window, the fighting with the police. Were these sort of things come into play? It's not that they're necessarily making physical or tactical maneuvers, but that somehow it's ultimately breaking a kind of ritualistic relationship that we have with objects around us in the world, that suddenly, a trash can become a barricade. And this barricade, this reflects something, you know, authentic or different. And the entire street transforms from an artery meant to deliver commodities across cities, and it transforms into a sort of a playground or a battleground. And that we can look at, very simple things like, you know, the way we talk to each other and the way we make decisions. And these can be what some comrades in Greece called, you know, time barricades. That's what essentially an occupation is. We take some space and we craft a new way of relating in that space that literally sort of creates a barricade against capitalist time. And that maybe that within these practices themselves are precisely the new rituals and the new ways of viewing the world that we need, but somehow we don't take them seriously enough. They're ephemeral. They just disappear. They like phantasms.
Traditionally, the shaman is a healer or guide who bridges the visible world of man and the invisible world of spirits, the world of gnosis, the hidden, obscure truth, the true truth, the truth divine, as opposed to the merely logical truth of man. Howard Phillips Lovecraft, 1890 to 1937, was a neurotic racist who wrote some of the most florid, bizarre, and absolutely hypnotic literature I've ever read. With Shelley, he's the greatest writer of science horror ever born, the genres Shakespeare and William Burroughs in one go. Lovecraft was a fearful man and the ultimate anti-shaman. He merged science and horror, monsters and gods, men and beasts. His ideas are enduring, and I'm pretty sure I would not want to meet him in real life. Lovecraft was a fear glutton. He merged fear of the state, alien, total, with fear of anarchy, omnipresent, Gnostic, inescapable, natural. He merged fear of the savage and unknown past with fear of the technologized and unhuman future. Fear of man's quest for knowledge with fear of man's ignorance and animality. Fear of a boring, bourgeois, unadventurous life with fear of the totality adventure that is death, and of what comes after. What lies beyond the highest peak, what can never be faced directly, what can never be written. He mercilessly, elaborately merges the roles of shaman and scientist. He precedes Grant Morrison and Neal Stephenson into a realm where science is Gnostic, revealing invisible truths. But Lovecraft, not trapped in some steampunk fantasy, sees that science is hardly freeing. It does not reveal a wonderland or a fantasia, but a storm, an invisible maelstrom at the heart of a supposed order, an all-consuming, gluttonous anarchy. Wild evil. Yes, Lovecraft affirms in fiction, we increasingly affirm, peering into our own DNA and quarks and the invisible orders that organize them, there is a secret answer. There is Gnosis. But no, you would not want to know it. It is cruel chance, the play of fangs, the soundless deaths of last members of outmoded species, the winkings out of stillborn universes. To know Gnosis would drive you mad. In H.P. Lovecraft, Against the World, Against Life, his greatest apologist, French novelist Michel Houellebecq, says of the anti-shaman, "Perhaps, he confirmed, something is hiding behind the curtains of reality that at times allows itself to be perceived. Something truly vile, in fact." 2. Gnostic Vertigo. The Lovecraftian mythos is an anti-mythology, a pantheon of godlike superintelligences that invisibly pervade our visible dimensions, organizing life to the extent they even notice us as life for their own inscrutable benefit. The hidden alien gods who serve as the foundations of the vertiginous final truth are supremely represented in Azathoth, the headless or acephalic will, the burbling all-being that sits at the center of each dimension and in its decadence generates the all, the pleroma. Azathoth is the profound incarnation of the, at the time of Lovecraft's writing, incipient concept of quantum uncertainty. Even if you've never read Lovecraft, it's enough to know that yes, there is a final truth. 2, yes, science can lead us to this gnosis. But 3, this final truth is that there is no order in the universe except the mad, unfeeling, cruel anti-order of the anarchy, which he calls Azathoth. This is all that's required to experience cosmic vertigo, a feeling that's hardly a matter of fantasy. It's a matter of a real orientation toward or a shunning of science, of capital R reason. And yet it allows for no escape back into the traditionally shamanic, the magical realm of thought before Plato, before the Enlightenment. There is no possibility of being saved by the invisibles of light, the Laertes, genii, angels, malaks, asuras, or kami. For they too would simply be aspects of this ultimate evil non-order, of anti-humanity. Every seance you successfully conduct, as with every scientific experiment, leads inexorably back to a foundational shifting chaos, an evil that blinds you to look at, that displaces your whole sense of order. A Gnostic vertigo. In Lovecraft, the rival ecstasies of science and shamanism finally merge, generating an ecstatic, many-tentacled maltheism. 3. Hero as reader as anti-shaman. The Lovecraftian hero, instead of the wild man come to the town to aid the villagers, is the villager gone to the woods to bring the neurasthenia of modernity into the whole world, to circumscribe the world in the evil of Gnosis, which in Lovecraft's materialist vision is not divine but mechanical and utterly horrible. The Lovecraftian hero's social role is that of a scientist, but he is also a shaman. He takes on the aspects of the gods he invokes, becoming more than human, traveling to see the gods whether accidentally or in order to learn their venomous gnosis, or in order to take advantage of their fantastic post-human techne. For example, flying through space and time, or commanding the titanic servitor beings called Shoggoths, which remain Lovecraft's greatest act of poetic genesis, their vast black vats of eyes, roiling and seething, stretching to uncontainable volumes of plastic organs underneath the dark of Antarctica. The hero reader becomes the shaman scientist. He is the keeper of a heavy, unusable silence. In this way, he is anti-Parsifal, anti-Messiah, who cannot help but unheal the land. He is aware of his status as chemical accident, starshit, and he can never return the foul gift of this truth. 4. The shaman is dead. Long live the shaman scientist. Long live the anti-visible. So why make the reader anti-shaman? Because when you collaborate with the shaman as mediator, then you too unheal modernity, and Lovecraft hated modernity. You unravel social norms in cities and techne. When you collaborate with the shaman as psychopomp, you too kill God, moving beyond divinity into a cold universe where Lovecraft is waiting, so far ahead of realism, he's described it perfectly. He has killed it. If other artists found their work upon realism, a mirroring of the real in order to understand it, then Lovecraft shatters this enterprise by, with the most fantastic-sounding stories of the 20th century, full of flying tentacles and time vampires, simply completing it. He offers an ultimate realism that takes into account the shamanic journey down to the quantum, to the length of Planck, into the gravity wells described by Einstein, out to the stars where the dust of man was forged. Lovecraft asks us to be psychopomp not for our egos or even for the collective ego, or God, but for the real itself, and thus for the operation of realism. Houellebecq calls Lovecraft a supreme antidote against all forms of realism. So where is the invisible? You have, in reading Lovecraft, moved it to the ultimate limit. In science, and so in the science terror of Lovecraft, you can explain anything, even the invisible. But that explanation at the small scale amounts to just because, or really worse, just because God hates you. God is not invisible, but anti-visible. Not irreal, but anti-real. The ultimate truth is that there is no truth, and therefore can be no real. Ouroboros. Thus, Lovecraft closes the epic of the shaman, the visionary mediator between the spirit world and man. Thus, the reader anti-shaman assemblage changes the invisible into the visible, into an unknowable unknowledge that is nonetheless materially real in this lifetime, in this universe, a knowledge reality beyond rescue. Thus, the angelic army is never coming to enlighten you. There is no further enlightenment. The scientist can only shake her head as her creation overcomes her, destroys her lab, and escapes into the city beyond, that city without limit, that doomed homogeneous global city that is modernity, from which Gnosis would have been banished had not, amazingly, this anti-shaman rescued it, only to affirm that it has 1,000,000 eyes, and swarms like the night come alive as a tidal wave of hungry, clever oil. If we can no longer believe in magic, in God, and if after the world wars we've grown supremely distrustful of scientific positivism as transcendent or realist art as healing, of reason is able to provide the answers that as spiritual animals we feel we need, then more than ever we need the model offered to us by thinkers in shadow such as Bataille, who reveals the science outside of dialectic and therefore outside of thought, and Derrida, who finds even in contemplation of unknowledge the corrupting trace of knowledge, a realism everywhere, a realism like the map of the empire that is exactly the size and shape of the empire, smothering it. And in writers such as Kafka and Lovecraft. To read Lovecraft is to descend into that spiral in which speech finally becomes the taunting jibes of the horrors you cannot taxonomize, the ultimate horror to the scientist, and in which vision becomes useless, a non-blindness that is nonetheless unable to sort form from form, alive from dead, or spirit from man, which is the ultimate horror to the shaman. To read Lovecraft is to kill the shaman and to wear his pelt, to make man the spirit animal and so transgress in every tradition. Unable to transform back because you were never not human, unable to ascend because above as below is only Azathoth, everywhere, everywhen, Azathoth. That's it. That's my
number 12. P. My mouth is tasteless, full of bone, an open jar of kindergarten paste, a staircase into a station to anticipate what could be conditional whiplash. No one deserving is ever sued. Creatures who never see the depth or platitude of victimhood. And I'm not talking about lions. The news has been a flood. Downturns this, depress that. Recess over there. Recess for a few. Tetherball is capitalism. An angel does a handstand for every lunch break dollar spent. A Christmas tree is burned alive with the disbursement of every bonus. Shredded pillows on Venus fly trap beds.
I'm gonna turn it down a little bit.
Okay.
Okay, start again.
Ready? How the Victorians nearly killed the werewolf. If you think about horror as a genre, we owe a lot to the Victorians, mythologically speaking, particularly to the Gothic movement. This is when a lot of the iconic stuff started happening. All the iconic stock characters are here. Tyrants, villains, bandits, maniacs, Byronic heroes, persecuted maidens, femme fatales, mad monks, magicians, monsters, demons, dragons, fallen angels, you name it, the Victorians had it. Particularly, two to note, were Bram Stoker's Dracula, written in 1897, and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, 1818. These are two of the tenets of the Gothic movement, and also two of the iconic depictions of monsters in Western society, especially for the modern era. But why at the height of the Gothic movement is there no seminal werewolf novel? Why is there no iconic werewolf novel, period? There were werewolf novels, but none of them were successful. The werewolf is an old legend, dating back to Gilgamesh even, and its characteristics have shifted over time, but by the 19th century, we had the werewolf as we roughly know it. It was a shapeshifter who changed from man to wolf. It was an involuntary transformation that happened on the full moon, and it involved a loss of human reasoning. And the way to become a werewolf was to be bitten by another werewolf, and the way to kill a werewolf was with a silver bullet. This is a shamanistic figure. It's an immensely popular in the same sorts of areas that the druids were: England, France, Ireland, Scotland. It's a figure linked to nature and to the chaos of the natural world. It is a figure in some ways older than society itself, and remarkably attuned to the most basic mysteries of consciousness, form, and alterity. So why is this offensive to the Victorians? One of the main principles of teratology, which is the field of literary criticism interested in the study of monsters, is that the monster's body is a cultural body. The monster embodies a certain cultural moment, a time, a feeling, a place. It incorporates fear, desire, anxiety, and fantasy, and it gives them life and an uncanny independence. The monster's body is pure culture. This is to some degree a symbiotic relationship. The monster defines the society, and the society defines the monster. So if we look at the Victorian society, this is a society ruled from the top with a strong sense of class. And since werewolves embody a complete otherness, that gives this gives expression to anxieties about working class degeneracy, aristocratic dependence, racial avatism, corporeality, sexuality, and the human relationship to the animal world. The werewolf represents a fear of contamination to the Victorians, and it's not an idea that's popular or seductive to a Victorian society. Vampires are popular because they have a mask. They can hide their true natures. This is an idea that speaks to the Victorians, the uncorrupted front and the corruptible behind. But the werewolf is only half human, and that's not enough for the Victorians. Frankenstein, on the other hand, is a scientific moral, and this is maybe where the werewolf makes the most inroads into Victorian society, is by being changed to a scientific moral. So what happens is they give birth not to a werewolf, but to Jekyll and Hyde, written in 1886 by Robert Louis Stevenson. This is as close as the Victorians will come to a werewolf. And so the werewolf, one of Latin West's most enduring mythological figures, could have died a death of obscurity at this moment. The Victorians very nearly killed the werewolf by turning him into a scientific figure, by turning him not as a figure of nature, but as a duality of science. But anyone who has seen a horror movie knows that the monster never stays dead. The writers from Shelley to Lovecraft were largely futurists and realists and especially psychologists. If you look at popular weird writers from Poe to Kipling, and of course look at Frankenstein and Dracula, these are therapy sessions between men and monsters, id and egos. And by the 19th century, writers looked to progress, universalism, a Calvinistic faith in man's ability to reason out everything, abstraction, taxonomy. No matter what vertigo is felt, each chaotic particle will settle towards order. This was the stabilizing Enlightenment and early capitalistic mindset. For the early capitalist, the future was possibility, the past was a lesson. The future could be predicted. There was hope in prediction. But by the turn of the 20th century, a new type of horror was arising from these 19th century attitudes. Writers such as H.P. Lovecraft re-occultized the future exactly by making it material, by making us see that indeed we can and in fact do dictate our futures, but that we are so limited by time and indeed by the very scientific laws we have quickly and irrationally and unthinkingly and dangerously discovered that our modernity and progress are no victories, but are throwing off the very old happy veil of faith and gentle ahistorical order. Science is going to kill us all, in other words. This was the lesson of the early 20th century, that we didn't know what science was going to do, that there was something more horrible about it. The highest folly was to know the truth, not because the truth is relative, but because it is terrifying. The horror of the early 20th century elevates the truth to the highest place, that of a Gnostic creator devil, and then the writers run the other way. This is what saves the werewolf. Only after nature and the werewolf is allowed to be weird again, only when science is as scary as everything else, can the werewolf be a successful figure in the collective unconscious. Take, for example, the very first two werewolf movies to be produced by Universal Pictures. Their production company basically created the iconic version of every monster we now know. The first, The Werewolf of London in 1935, is scientific. The protagonist is a botanist, and he's, upon being bitten, he searches for a scientific solution to his problem. It's basically a rehashing of Jekyll and Hyde. There's a lot of scenes of take place in labs. There's a lot of beakers bubbling over with elixirs. It's another attempt to rationalize the werewolf, to force him to a scientific narrative. It's a commercial and critical failure. But the Wolfman in 1941 is the one you probably know about, and for good reason. This is the one with Lon Chaney in his famous werewolf makeup. His performance is one reason why this version sticks. There's also a more mystical story, a more shamanistic version of the werewolf, not tied to science, but back to nature again. Whereas Werewolf of London is an urban scientific film, The Wolfman takes place in Wales, and most of the scenes are outside in nature. There's a big swamp. There's no attempt to explain lycanthropy or cure it. It is what it is, and that's all we get. The modern tension between werewolf and modern society, between the shaman and the post-shaman world, this is what gives the werewolf his uncanniness, that the shaman has somehow been transferred out of the shamanistic world and into the modern world. The Victorians covered up the werewolf, and he assimilated all of their values without incorporating them, and he emerges, fully formed in a world that's not prepared for him. We are uneasy about the role of nature in the shaman. Werewolves have become shorthand for all sorts of outsiders in our society that we have to fear. Take, for example, Remus Lupin in Harry Potter, who's indicative of AIDS, or Jacob, the werewolf in Twilight, who represents the minority, and particularly to note in this case, the Native American minority, which is itself a shamanistic society. The werewolf is popular now. That's the strangest part. It's a sympathetic werewolf. Coming to the end of a vampire trend, coming to the end of a trend about a monster who literally sucks the blood out of his victims, in a wildly successful capitalistic society, we now have a sudden resurgence of werewolves, of creatures that are one with nature and that try and live in harmony with nature and are uncanny because of their dual citizenship in both the natural and the modern world. What can we attribute to this? Perhaps the retaliation against a capitalistic society indicated by the vampire, the rise of environmentalism. Whatever the case, the werewolf has changed, but he has persisted as an outsider in our midst. Chew on that one for a minute.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes I can feel it when I'm just sitting around thinking about it. All these adventures happening in our own blood. Miracle happenstance under a kneecap. Chance encounters in a capillary. All this love coursing up and down the continent of our beings like a secret that was never a secret at all.
We'd looked at the map in the library with Xavier, his gnarled pointer finger covered in plantar warts, tapping the spot in the center 3 times. The map is accurate for 10:30 Sunday night, Xavier said. He folded his hands over the silver handle of his cane and rocked on his heels. With or without the book, you have to be back to the outer circle before the sky changes. Promise me. I cannot remember if Vega answered him or if I did. Either way, we swore we'd be there. The Book of Dead Names, Xavier explained, was proof that the Greek gods were real. The book contained a list of everyone who had crossed over, or who would, whether they had the money to pay Charon for the ride across the River Styx or not. New names were added daily. Charon guarded it, ticking off the names as new souls arrived. Xavier sent Vega and I to retrieve it. Now I had the book in my satchel, and it was surprisingly light. I wanted to find a place to sit down so we could open the book. But Vega had argued against this even while we were in the tunnel. I thought our names might already be inscribed there, and if we truly were doomed, I wanted to stay where we were, so I could map out the location of every single freckle on our body before it was too late. Vega took my hand and walked north, pulling me along behind her like a wagon. Xavier warned us against the spells of the inner circle and those that would be cast specifically for us once we had the book in hand. He trained us to fight them too, but I have always been weak. Vega, on the other hand, she is a calm, graceful swan. We made it to the outer circle a few minutes before 10:30. Xavier was waiting for us. He took the book from me and flipped through 500, 600, maybe 700 pages, dabbing the tip of his finger with his tongue every now and again. The pages of the book stuck together when he turned them. Eventually, he found his own name scrawled in black ink along with all the others. This is how Vega and I came to have the Book of Dead Names. And so we run. I don't know where we will ever be safe. What I do know is this. If Vega's name appears in the book and mine does not, I will write my name in the margin myself.